Welcome back to Emerge. This week, my guest is Nora Bateson. Nora is a filmmaker, writer, educator, lecturer, and president of the International Bateson Institute. In this conversation together, we talk about how systems learn and evolve, the importance of moving between contexts, Nora's warm data labs, how our dreams of incremental change have failed, and how radical systems change is likely to emerge from the liminal space between institutions. Please enjoy this episode of Emerge. Welcome back to another episode of Emerge. This week on the show, my guest is Nora Bateson. Nora is a filmmaker, writer, educator, lecturer, and president of the International Bateson Institute. Nora, welcome to Emerge.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. And so, Nora, I first discovered your work while I was doing research for the show I did on Holochain. And I think I found just you had been interviewed by them. You know, you had written about sort of ideas that were similar about how the nature of our data architecture tends to create a kind of relationship to life that is extremely problematic. And since then, I've kind of been seeing you elsewhere. I've looked into your warm data labs, and you've just been doing incredibly interesting work from my perspective at the intersection of kind of like systems theory, data science, and mysticism, which I think is a very fascinating intersection. And so we'll get into perhaps these things like warm data, but I first wanted to start with a question that came to me after listening to your interview, your recent interview with Douglas Rushkoff, which is wonderful. I'll link to it in the show notes. And that's that. So for those who are listening who don't know, Gregory Bateson was your father. Gregory Bateson is, I suppose, like an OG systems theorist, like kind of nature mystic, radical human being. And you grew up, I think you said in the conversation with Douglas, kind of being exposed to some of the greatest thinkers and most radical ideas of that time. And I'm curious, like, most of us discover these kinds of alternative ways of thinking later on in life, like after we escape, you know, mainstream education and so on. But I'm curious, like, how do you think hearing those kinds of conversations and the divergent viewpoints and perspectives, like around the dinner table, affected your own work and perspectives on change?
You know, this is an interesting question because I don't think that I recognized how unique my upbringing was. Of course, how could you, right? You know, when someone says, what was it like to grow up the way you grew up? It's sort of like, well, it was a lot like growing up because it was the only way that I knew how to grow up. It's not, it was just sort of the only thing there. But there are some significant things that I think I could say to that. And one of them is that this body of theoretical and intellectual work that we know of as systems theory and complexity theory is this, it's so rich and it's a wonderful pursuit of knowledge, of history, of, I mean, everything from, you know, calculable mathematics and chaos to all sorts of different versions and models of systems and complex responsive adapting systems. The thing is that one of the traps of Western civilization is the trap of deferring to a particular set of criteria and tonalities that give authorization and credibility to what is knowledge, to are you Are you credible? Are you reasonable? Are you rational? Have you done your homework? Do you know what you're talking about? Are you an expert? How do we know when to believe someone or whether or not we should be impressed by them? That kind of thing. And what was interesting in the difference for me was that while I loved embarking on the intellectual, theoretical, academic aspect of systems and complexity theory, I had a first coat of paint, if you will. And that first coat of paint was a way of life that was inclusive of a systemic perspective and a kind of general moment-to-moment perception of the interdependencies that we live within. So breakfast was full of that. The idea that you could separate anything from anything was not possible at any level of my life at any moment from the beginning onward. So it wasn't just an intellectual pursuit. It was a way of living, of communicating, of developing relationships, of thinking about everything from food to wellness to friendship to work to nature to, you know, my own body or even my art. So that's a significant difference. And I honestly didn't really realize how significant it was for a long time. And it took me until I was kind of moving through the circuits in the systems world and recognizing there's some part of me that responds at an instinctual level when the work on systems gets too theoretical or too disembodied, or actually starts to have that smack of mechanism creeping back into it, right? So that's, I guess, the long way of saying this isn't just about your intellect. It also takes perception that comes through the body. It takes perception that's in the nonverbal, non-conscious realms of perception. It takes complexity to perceive complexity. Mm. And I think that because I had the upbringing that I had a little more experience of that to begin with. And my dad was old, right? So he wasn't a young man when I was born. He had already been working with this way of perceiving the world for decades. And he was interested. He used to say, it doesn't count until you have it in your elbows.
I love that. That's really cool. And so, I mean, it's almost like when I hear you say that, what comes to mind is like, for me, and I think for a lot of the people that I know, my peers, like we had to sort of uninstall a certain kind of operating system that did act as if we could isolate and separate aspects of reality and know them sort of independently from the rest of the whole shebang. And then we had to sort of further almost install or discover an operating system that resisted that tendency, which for me at least had become so natural just as a result of my education and upbringing. Whereas you never, it sounds like you kind of had that package pre-installed, you know, so to speak, or already that was already present in your experience, which that makes a lot of sense. And I love this idea of it's not real until you can feel it in your elbows. And I'd love to kind of continue to explore that direction. You write in three things to remember about responding to interdependency, which is, this is a huge topic of the show, right? Is like there's a kind of meta crisis or meta crisis that's happening on the planet right now. And things like climate change, things like exponential technology, nuclear war, all of these are kind of symptoms of an interrelated systemic kind of crisis, right? That we've mm-hmm. designed bad systems that are giving rise to things that might self or might terminate the human experiment. And you say that, you know, wicked problems require intersystemic change, not siloed solutions, which, you know, was one of the earliest things I learned as a result of doing the inquiry of this show. And something I learned also at Occupy Wall Street, you know, our problems are interconnected and perhaps also our solutions are interconnected. And then you say, mm-hmm. two, taking action before perception change produces repeated errors and short circuits the necessary complexity. Ditch linear strategy. And then third, this is what I want to kind of focus on for a little bit, is you say perception is intellectual, emotional, physical, cultural, and relational. Making sense is sensorial. Increasing sensitivity is necessary to find new ways through old patterns. And so, you know, there is, I think, a lot of talk. It's really cool to talk about systems theory. It's really cool to talk about nonlinear change and emergence. What does it take from your perspective to become an instrument that is able to actually embody this sort of perspective? Like what is the difference that makes the difference there from your perspective? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting that you started with that cue of what is the difference that makes a difference. So let's start there. That little phrase, the difference that makes a difference, was what my father referred to as one of the potential definitions of information. And what does that mean? It means that, you know, when you can run your finger over your the seam in your jeans and you feel that little bump on the seam, that you are sensing a difference, right? And in that, you are able to build the information around the contrast of what both sides of that difference are, by generating relational, contrasting, comparison information. So increasing sensitivity to relational information is what we're talking about. And I like to think about systems thinking, not so much in terms of that term, which has been used widely, but to kind of push it to the next level and talk about contextual sensitivity or transcontextual sensitivity. So the capacity to perceive contextual relational interaction process, exchange, communication, aesthetic. That is something that we do as living beings, but it's not something that we're given training in. In fact, I would suggest that our education system, in fact, trains us to draw separations so that you might say, you know, right now I'm looking at my breakfast cereal. This is breakfast cereal. As opposed to, this is a sort of a relational consequence of all sorts of history of agriculture, of the soil bacteria, of mothers that have fed their children over generations and developed this recipe and this grain and this notion of breakfast that we are sharing together. This thing that is on the table here is a manifestation of lots of different relational processes that have brought us to this moment, in this relational moment with these people in this day, right? And that it seems arduous, or it seems much to be thinking in all those contexts all the time. But actually, it's not. Actually, it's not that big of a stretch. It's just sort of a muscle that we don't use. And it has everything to do, I think, with this kind of practice of even trying to define the simplest things, like, you know, whatever, the jar of muesli on the table, as what is this thing, not in terms of its definition, but in terms of its relationships. Like, if you were going to describe your coffee cup in the morning, not in terms of the cup, but in terms of its relationships, how would you begin to do that? And then how would you describe yourself? Not necessarily in terms of the data of how much you weigh or where you were born or what your birthday is or, you know, that sort of stuff, but in terms of your relationships, in terms of your interactive processes, who are you? How would you describe yourself? And if you were to describe your community, how would you begin to describe that community in through those sorts of frames and lenses and in that kind of language? What would you begin to find even in your own description? So I think that that's part of it. And noticing description is a big part of this. That in our description, if you sort of have your governor on board, that's kind of saying, okay, well, how much complexity have you put in this description? How much relational information can you sense into? And then expand that. Let that be a kind of barometer for the sensitivity that's there, and let it grow.
Yes.
Explore into new territories, new kinds of language, new textures of communication. Because in order to really express anything complex, it takes many more than one version of description.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I really appreciate about this approach is, so I trained for some years in a monastery, and like meditation has been one of the primary ways that I've gotten to sort of experience interdependence. And within the kind of spiritual world, broadly speaking, I think there's a great emphasis on the embodiment, the kind of physical experience almost, or even perceptual experience of interdependency. And what I love that you're inviting in is a kind of like recognition of the full potential spectrum of the realization of interdependency, whereby it can become, you know, why limit it to our physical embodiment and not expand it into the intellectual and the relational and then back? And then, you know, weaving between these different perspectives, you get a richer and richer sense of the kind of reality and multifacetedness of interdependency. And I love that there is that invitation. And you know, you say that If humanity is to make it to the next level in this evolutionary game, it will be through our recognition of our interdependency to each other and to the organisms of our biosphere. And it's a process, or that recognition, it seems to me, is not going to just be like we meditate and all of a sudden we like have a moment where we're like, oh, I'm one with everything. But instead, it's by reconstructing all of the aspects of our civilization to affirm our interdependency and to facilitate a kind of like inquiry into how we are already interdependent and mutually dependent and so on and so forth. And my sense is also that that's kind of like what you are attempting to cultivate in the warm data labs. Is that an accurate way of sort of sensing into what that is?
Absolutely. And I'm having so much fun with these warm data labs. Mm. And when I say fun, what I really mean is that I have been quite frustrated, as I think a lot of people have been. You noted that I've been around these conversations for a long time. And, you know, at those dinner tables, in those conversations my parents and their friends were having in the early 70s, sadly, a great deal of what we're talking about today was the same conversation we were having then. And so what's blocking this? Why can't we get anywhere? What's the problem? And the issue, I think one of them has been that it's very difficult to actually convey an understanding of systems in a world, and particularly in the context of the sort of Western narrative, which isn't just located in the Western world, that has broken everything into parts. And to reassemble things like causation in ways that are not linear. And, you know, that sounds like it's sort of, we're used to talking about that now, but to actually do it is another thing altogether. And, you know, it's easy enough to talk about the interconnectedness or the interrelational process, but to actually get inside those relational processes and begin to discover them and go deep is another thing. The itch to map out the system, to make a list of the stakeholders, to draw the thing out as a diagram, to find out how it functions, to strategize a way to hack the complexity, to manage the uncertainty. These things are everywhere right now. And the more urgent the call is to make systemic change, the more this urgency seems to produce almost mechanistic response that often comes under the auspices of systems thinking or of complexity work. And so I have been so frustrated because I just kept feeling like, but wait a second, there's so much more. And if we're going to really be talking about how to deal with climate change, all right, this is, on the one hand, it's absolutely imperative that we have the climate science there and that we be able to measure the carbon emissions and that we be able to recognize the importance that that kind of scientific research can deliver. But if we don't also understand the patterns and the relational processes through which families feed their children breakfast, we are not going to be able to interact and respond to the deep complexity that is necessary for real systems change. So the warm data lab process for me has been it's like oxygen. It's like finally I'm in a room full of people who in about an hour and a half have access to an understanding of the vivid and animated interdependency of our world. And I can tell you, I have spent decades trying to teach systems thinking, working with people who were teaching systems theory and so on. And for the most part, to be perfectly honest, those efforts were unsuccessful. There were some people who came in who got it, but to be honest, I think they probably got it before they came. And most of them would leave kind of shaking their head saying, well, that was interesting. And I can see that it's important, but it's really abstract. And I have no idea what to do with that in my job on Monday. And it's not very practical. How am I supposed to live my life with all that interdependency and complexity? That's just in the way. I just need to know what I need to do to identify the problem, make a strategy, and solve it. And that was sort of the experience that I was having. And then I happened across this piece in Steps, my dad's book, Steps to an Ecology of Mind, about transcontextual experience. And I'd read it 1,000 times. I don't know. Finally, one day it popped out and jumped up and banged me on the head. And I thought, my God, that's the piece. It's that not only do we have to recognize that systemic relational process is happening in a context, it's happening in multiple contexts. So this attempt to draw out these flat, two-dimensional systems diagrams was disastrous. And it kept feeling like something was somehow impoverished about it, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was until I happened into that. And at the same time, I was working with the first round of work that the Bateson Institute did, which was questioning how do systems get unstuck. And when we started working with this question of stuckness, you know, obviously there's a lot of stuckness in our world. The economy seems to be stuck, and the education system seems to be stuck, and the healthcare system seems to be stuck, and everything seems to be so stuck, and yet we need change. We know we need change. Why can't we make any change? Well, we can't make any change because we're stuck. And so that seemed like a good place to start. And when we started working there, what we realized was that it's really difficult to identify a stuck system, actually, because the second you start to really look at what the stuckness is, if you kind of get a little wider, you realize there's all this compensatory relational process that's holding that stuckness in place. So our economic patterns may be sort of stuck, but if you look at the compensatory processes of, you know, the wealth gap and the increases in poverty and the destruction to the ecological world, those things aren't stuck at all. There are huge sacrifices being made to keep our economic system stuck in the way that it is right now. So is it stuck? Where's the edge of the stuck system, right? And so we went to work with the best stuck system that we could come up with, which was the idea or the experience of the body in paralysis. That seemed to be a good example of a stuck system, that paralysis seemed like a stuckness and the body is a complex living system. So how does this thing get unstuck? And we were working with some really fascinating people in Italy, and that's another podcast. But what we learned from the way they were working with paralysis and terminal pain, I might add, was that systems don't get unstuck. That's not what happened. There are not problems that get solved in that sense. What there is this incredible transcontextual interaction and shifting of sense-making processes that lead to a kind of learning. So the meme here is systems don't get unstuck, they learn. And when they learn, that stuckness kind of just moves out of the contextual process. So what is happening there? How is that working? How can we begin to study that as a pattern of entering the question of systems change? I'm assuming, Daniel, that in this conversation, we're in agreement that we need some kind of systems change because, well, dot, dot, dot. So what we discovered was that there was this way in which living systems are sense-making And that's such a used term right now. I want to use a different one. Let's say the way that an organism, whether it's a human being or a bacteria or a tree or a forest, the way that that living system is learning to be in its world. Okay, and when you look at that, remembering that learning need not be a positive gradient accumulation of knowledge. Okay, you can learn to lie. You can learn to be destructive, right? So how is this system learning to be? And that is by definition from the beginning a transcontextual process. So if you have a crooked tree in the woods, that crooked tree is in relationship and responding to the light, the water, the bacteria in the soil, the earthworms, the birds, the human beings, the wind, the shadows of the other trees, right? There's a lot. And that crookedness is an expression of its transcontextual responsiveness to being where it is. And so how do we then begin to study those relational processes, right? So because the contextual part is really fascinating. And if you think about even, you know, your own identity in that sense. So who am I? Well, there's a lot of contexts that I am. I'm a mom, I'm a daughter. I am 40 trillion organisms. I'm a woman. I'm an American, but I am also I'm also a Swedish citizen. I am I'm 50 years old, so I'm part of a particular generation, and that's a whole context. I am my language. I am my education, my set of demographics and my privileges. Right, I am that crazy kid that grew up in the Esalen Lodge amongst all that 70s upheaval. So all those different contexts that form my identity are always there. They're in a kind of, you know, if you think about a pinball machine, remember playing pinball and the ball would kind of bounce between all these different things, ding, 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 ding. That's kind of what's happening in me, is that when I'm responding to any situation, there's all this existing experience inside me that is doing that difference that makes a difference, comparison, contrasting. The information or the experience I'm having is entering into me into an already existing set of moving, shifting, responding, contextual processes. Isn't that so cool? So some of that is conscious, but a lot of it isn't, right? When you walk across a room, you don't really pay attention to the texture of the floor under your feet. Unless it happens to have nails in it and you're watching out for it. You don't happen to really think about the temperature in the room, or, you know, you probably aren't thinking about the way that that doorknob would taste, but somehow you know those things. That information is in you, and it's in all these different contextual frames and possibilities. So the Warm Data Lab is an externalization of that. Basically, it's the possibility of looking at a complex, wicked problem. People love that word, wicked. I don't know if it's really wicked, but I remember when I was an 80s kid and the skateboard boys did really cool tricks and they were wicked cool. So I kind of like that word. And so you take that big question, right? The big ones that just, oops, they're just too big to handle, and allow the context to open up. What are the contexts of health? Right? Health is ecological. Health is financial. Health is Health is in your education system. Health is in the political system. Health is in the history. Health is in the culture. Health is in your spirituality or your religion. Health is in the family. Health is in the food. Those are all different contexts of health, right? And then what happens in the room is people move between those different contexts in a particular set of formats. There's a lot of theory under it, so I'll spare you. But basically what happens is as you move from context to context, the depth of understanding of this interdependency becomes personal. It becomes clear in ways that are crossing a lot of different aspects of each person as a sense-making organism. So it's, you can't do it without the other people. Everybody has to move around to do this. It's all in the conversation. Mm. And when you go from the context of economy to the context of education, there's surprising things that happen. And there are crossovers, there are overlappings, there are these ways in which personal experience starts to tie together. And this is a way to bring a room full of people to a very precious moment that is the beginning of another whole level of conversation. Mm. So that then when you're asking these people, okay, what can we do to increase health in our lives as individuals, as communities, and up through the biosphere? Yeah. That group of people is ready to have a completely different conversation. And for me, that's the most important thing we can do right now, is be having a conversation that starts with the interdependency on board, and that interdependency not be purely intellectual, but be intellectual, right. Not be purely emotional, but be emotional, not be purely in the individual, but have the individual inside it, not be purely in the collective, but be possible through the collective, so that all of these aspects are in the living vitality of the information that we're working
on. Yes, yeah.
So for me, that's what's exciting. And I am so, like a lot of people right now, moving through the days, trying to recognize with due sensitivity that there's a lot of darkness right now. And for me, this is where I see real movement. I'm seeing incredibly significant and profound connections and linkings and relinkings get made as this room begins to learn to make sense in a new way. It's that how do systems learn question. The room becomes a system and it's learning to make sense of its world in a new way. And those conditions in which that can happen are, I just think it's so exciting. And I'm excited to have something to be excited about because it's really depressing out there right now.
Well, and so this is, extremely interesting and rad. Like, I think one of the themes of this podcast has been, what will really make the difference over the long term in terms of systems change is learning to speak to each other and even to ourselves in a new way that kind of embodies this almost different ontology or epistemology or worldview or however you want to frame it. And it sounds like you've created a kind of dojo or a training space by which people can, over the course of the training, learn to have conversations in that way that seems to be needed right now. And I'd love to kind of then explore the relationship between this different way of having conversations, or even more broadly, I think it's a different way of seeing the world, and its relationship with like a really radical systems change, because what you said in your conversation with Douglas Rushkoff, which I was really struck by, was that you thought it was both more important and perhaps easier to work towards a full-scale systems transformation than kind of like incremental changes across silos. And so what's, you know, how do you see the relationship between these different kinds of conversations that are possible and that are happened through the Warm Data Labs and this kind of radical full-scale systems transformation?
Well, one thing that has changed since those conversations that my dad and his colleagues were having, is that in this moment, I think it's becoming fairly obvious that our dreams of incremental change from within the system, from within the various institutions, that that didn't work, that didn't happen. You know, when I was growing up, and I'm sure you had this also, there was this idea that if you wanted to do something significant, you need to do it from within. If you have problems with the education system, become a teacher and change it from the inside. That kind of a mythology. Here we are. It's 2018. I'm not going to go too deep into the ways in which that didn't work. It should be fairly obvious. Let's go back to the Warm Data Lab for a second. So in that description that I was giving you a moment ago, we were talking about health and we had all these different contexts, all right? And you could think that if you were going to change health, that what you really need to do is put more money into the healthcare system or to educate people that they need to exercise more or to tell them that they have to eat organic food or, you know, those sorts of things, right? But if you start talking about systems change, what you're actually getting at is the space between those different institutional concepts. So where is the health? Is health political? Is health educational? Is health ecological? Is health historical or cultural or spiritual? Where is it? And it's a kind of a shell game of pulling it apart to recognize that it's in the middle, right? That where your health actually is in that liminal space between all of those, right? It's not in those institutions, it's between them. So we've spent the last several decades trying to incrementally change these institutions from within, but actually, what we really can change is our relationship to them. And if we create community in that liminal space, in the middle, and that community, like you said, is generating new language, is generating new patterns of interaction, then that community, the institutions will change in response. So it's that process of recognizing that you are not the parts of your body. You are the relationship between the parts of your body. You know, you could put Nora in pieces on a big slab and I would not be Nora. Because it's not in the parts, it's in the relationship between them. So, I mean, certainly I need my heart and in that sense it is the parts, but in that relationship between the parts is where you're going to get the characteristics, the details, the differences that make a difference, that minutia that creates aliveness of a system. So, in my experience, in any kind of significant systems change moments that I've witnessed in various levels, it's not as hard to have the systems move all at once as it is to try to get one piece to change. And then when you jump over to the next piece to try to get it to change, the first piece goes back how it was. Right? We have this kind of set of ecological patterns. Think of the institutional world as an ecology in and of itself. There is an interdependency between our institutions that is patterned and relational, very much like a jungle. And in that sense, we as human beings are pretty good anthropologists. We're taking good care of that, that ecology. It's just really wildly out of sync with the larger ecology. So how are we going to change one aspect of an ecology when those patterns will drag it back or create consequences of consequences of consequences in all these different directions when you try to change one piece, right? The system as a whole can learn. But when you try to, you know, have one aspect of it change, the rest of it will just fall back into the old patterns. So that was sort of where I was going with that. And when you pop that into the sort of the larger daunting horizons of governance change, of economic change, of culture change, what does that look like? Where are we going? How are we going to get out of these patterns? Because it doesn't make sense to change the patterns that I need to survive through next week.
Mm.
Right? I need to be able to go to the grocery store. I need to be able to move around in various transportation systems. I need to be able to do the work that I do to get in the economics that I need to go to the grocery store. You know, there's all these things and they're all wound into each other. And they come down to my survival and my children's survival through next month. But the double bind of it all is that to do that, I'm putting in jeopardy the larger question of survival for not only my family, but thousands of other species and humanity itself. So we have a situation.
Double. I love that frame of a double bind. I've never heard that before, but it does. That seems exactly right. And so, so keep going. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's just I was pulled forth by the way you described that. What is there to be done then? How do we escape this double bind and actually transform the system?
I hope you're not expecting me to actually answer that.
I'm hoping that you'll point in directions that will make our work a little bit more accessible. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So here's my best go. Yeah. All right. So obviously when I have done these warm data labs and when I have had my greatest success and in my research of looking at how systems learn and how systems change, here is what I have observed, is that if you start off thinking you know what the problem is, there's some aspect lurking that also thinks you know what the solution is. And that's not a good place to start. So when you dive into that transcontextual process and you go into that, the what I would call the warm data alongside all the other data we've got, what comes out is going to surprise you. And if you think you know where you're going before you go in, you sacrifice that surprise. So in my experience, we do not have the luxury right now to think that we can begin to enact solutions because we don't really understand the complexity that we're in. And we're up against a time bomb, of urgency from all these different directions. I mean, political unrest, culture unrest, ecological unrest, climate change. Our people's families are falling apart. The levels of depression, of anxiety, of suicides, of cancer, of bankruptcy, of just existential crisis are rising quickly. And so the need to work together toward deepening our understanding of interdependency, not as a model that we can draw on the whiteboard, but as the rich inner world that we all inhabit together, externally, internally, ecologically, and so on. There are clues. There are shiftings that can happen. My take is they're going to come from the liminal space. They're going to come from the space in between. They're going to come from the community and the language and the process, the understandings that we build together in the space in between. And that we don't know what they are yet because we haven't built the community there yet. So we need contexts for the context. Because when I work with people who are in climate science, they only know climate science. They're not allowed to talk about depression and suicides in families, right? They're not talking about that. When I talk to family therapists, they're talking about depression and suicides in families, but they're not allowed to speak to carbon levels or plastics in the ocean. Right. When I talk to educators, the educators, the people who are in our schools are not allowed to speak about culture change or the development and iterations of language and spirituality. They're not allowed to go there. So we have these silos that are obscuring everyone's capacity, not only to perceive context, but more importantly, to talk about it with each other.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's a big piece. For me, that's a big piece.
Totally. And it strikes me that like the result of doing that kind of inquiry together would inevitably be, yes, a new kind of conversation. But it would also be a new sense of identity for ourselves, a new story of what it means to be human and be responsible to each other and for each other. Like what it sounds to me, and I you can reject this kind of languaging if you like, but that the Warm Data Lab is a way of reestablishing a kind of meta context for our participation in the world that, you know, to some degree, religions used to do, but now we're kind of floating about in a fragmented absence or vacuum of this kind of context, and that there's a way into realizing our interdependency that, you know, Warm Data Labs are pointing to, and you know, I would say there are other ways in, but nonetheless, this idea, of kind of generating together a new kind of context that calls forth our responsibility and lets us become the kind of people and have the kind of conversations that would lead to a transformation of the world. Is that a kind of way of understanding what you're pointing to?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm pointing to. And it has everything to do with recognizing, like you were saying at the beginning of this conversation, that, in order to do complexity, we have to be able to recognize our own complexity and use complexity to do it. Right? So one person can't do the research on a complex system. It takes multiple perspectives. It takes multiple versions. It takes multiple languages, multiple textures of description. It takes multiple versions of experience. It takes all kinds of depth to do that. Mm. But usually what we do when we study things, we pull them out of context. It's the first thing that happens. And by pulling things out of context, we can get them to sit still. We can measure them. We can define them. We can do all sorts of things.
Right. But it also strikes me in hearing you talk, like context itself is a bit wiggly, right? Like, I mean, Carl Sagan has that quote, if you want to bake an apple pie from scratch, first create the entire universe. So like what context you pick, I mean, as soon as we're talking about including context, we're kind of also talking about a level of ambiguity and nebulosity that I imagine would also be quite disturbing to people who believe you can actually know anything.
And that's okay. You know, the thing is that there's definitely the mind boggle factor. Mm. And I'm not too worried about the mind boggle factor. And I'll tell you why. Because we have reductionist science. I'm not saying throw it out. You know, it's great. If you want to actually know something and you want to measure it and you want to define it, we have that tool. We got that. No problem. And then when you realize that that wasn't enough information, that you also have to know what that frog does in the pond, then we need to have that kind of information. And that's another sort of information. And you are never going to have it all. Hmm. There's no conceivable possible way, because it's continuing to move. It's continuing to be in response to its relational processes and the other organisms that are continuing to change and respond also. So you're never going to have it all.
Right.
It's not about, you know, we're going to get all the worm data in the world and then we're going to know what it is. Because in the process, we will have changed, right? So we'll have another question by the time we get there. So
So it seems like it's more about like oscillating between these different perspectives. Is that kind of a sense of what you're pointing to? So that we have access to the warm data perspective and the cold, hard data, so to speak, perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that oscillation, there is participation of you as a complex organism inside a complex system, observing, shifting your observations, sharing your observations. You know what? That is the interdependency,
mm-hmm.
right? You're in it. And so it's just this recognition of what has always been there.
Mm.
So it's not about gathering all the information. It's about knowing that we are in a world that functions like that.
Mm.
And that changes everything, right? So that when you want to really make change at the level of governance or economy, you recognize that this is not actually about currency, for Christ's sake. This is about things like the idea of happiness or the notion of success or the intergenerational expectations or my understanding of what it means to be blessed by God. My goodness, mm-hmm. How does that figure in, you know?
Mm.
So if you go switching around currencies, that's fun, but that's not going to create systems change.
Mm. So, you know, I feel like we've opened up a space where I could just talk for many hours about the ramifications and consequences of what you just brought. But, you know, we don't have much time. And I do want to ask you, Nora, because you're somebody that sort of studies systems and embodies this sort of perceptual shift that you're pointing to or spends time in that kind of way of perceiving, you know, looking out in the world, like I read a study recently, I linked to it on my Twitter profile, I'll link to it in the show notes, that estimated that we have, you know, at the time of the writing of the paper, about 80 months left until some kind of systems collapse. And this was based on pretty like rigorous thinking. And I've heard similar-ish kinds of numbers thrown around, you know, that's five-ish years, five, 6 years, I think. And, you know, are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Do you feel like And what will it take? What are you hopeful for? Like, what is the thing that might actually, in this case, be the difference that makes the difference that we could up-level to a new kind of game as a human experiment?
I don't know. I guess here's what I'm working on is that I think we're going to hit some big bumps no matter what. We're going to hit big bumps. And the only thing that I know for sure about surfing those big bumps or being in those big bumps, surviving or not surviving those big bumps, is that it matters what kind of care and willingness to tend to each other and our biosphere we have as an impulse. Not as a protocol, not as a policy, not as a mandate, as an impulse. And the more I have worked with this warm data process, the more I'm working with this transcontextual set of ideas, the more what I am witnessing is and observing is the need to open up a kind of understanding of health and well-being as being something that is collective. It's not necessarily individual. I mean, it includes the individual, but my health is not ending at the edge of my skin. It includes my family, my community, the biosphere, and so on. My microbacteria is connected to the soil. I can't get out of that. So the tending that I see is this kind of multi-faceted tending to each other and to the world around us. And that's where I'm putting my efforts right now. It's not that we won't hit bumps. We're going to hit bumps. It's more what kind of care can we offer in the trauma of that? And I think that, you know, sort of in the rear view mirror, if you will, that impulse to tend and to care for each other and the environment, that is the impulse that will also generate another kind of perceiving, another kind of research, another kind of broad scale policy making, and so on and so forth. So that's what I see. I'm interested in this. I don't want to call it reciprocity of care because it's not the idea that if I care for you, you're going to care for me. It's more like a spontaneous mutual recognition of our collective care. And it's cross-cultural, cross-species, cross-generational. What does that look like? How do we do that? And if you've ever been on stage with a group of people and you've done any kind of improv, there's this moment where there's this kind of attention that you pay. And you listen in a particular kind of wide angle listening. And you listen with your own individual process and particular character in mind, but you listen with a kind of sensitivity to the group and the larger story and so on. It's this zoom in, zoom out, multi-contextual attention. And that's, I think, what we mean by collaboration. It's not that you're going to do your part and I'm going to do my part and we're going to, you know, form this kind of machine. It's that we're all going someplace we've never been before, and we're going to have to do what we haven't done before. And in order to do that, we're going to have to learn together. And the way you learn is not the same way that I learn. It's not like we're going to learn the same things in that mutual learning. We're going to learn different things, right? All the experiences inside you will form a different kind of alchemy for whatever experience lies ahead of you. Then the experiences inside me are another sort of alchemy. And even if we're standing there and the tree falls in front of both of us, our experience of that tree falling is not the same.
Yeah.
So I think that ultimately this has to do with the willingness to stop holding back. And to participate in this incredible improvisational act of the human play.
That's beautiful. Yeah. And I mean, there's so, I feel so much like I enter, when I listen to you speak, like I enter into a kind of mind space or way of seeing the world that I typically get through like, I don't know if you're familiar with this term, like Dharma talks, like people talking about meditation and Buddhism. And, you know, I have a history with that. And they, as they speak, they kind of weave for you this different world, this different possibility for your consciousness. And it's so fascinating, like the kind of space that you bring me to as I hear you speak is a similar one. It's a one where it feels like, yeah, I I'm not good at communicating from there. Like to speak from that place requires, and this is another topic we've explored in the show, that to communicate from that space requires like a completely different communicative skill set. Right? Like even the way that language is constructed to some degree seems antithetical to kind of naming what it's like to be in and participate in this different human ecology. And yeah, so I just want to like, I love that you've discovered, it seems like a unique way into that sense of being. And it's a real joy to talk to you, Nora. I hope to someday experience one of your warm data labs. It sounds like just a real unique and wondrous experience. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Is there anything that, you know, you want to leave the audience with before we end this conversation?
Well, first of all, I just want to catch up with what you just said and say, I don't think that you are nearly as limited as you make yourself out to be in terms of communicating around this. I love the way that you're communicating in this sphere. So for whatever it's worth, I recognize a kindred spirit there. And in terms of any last words, I guess, there is something. You were saying at the beginning something about this is science and it's philosophy and it's mystical. And when you said that, I thought, oh my God, he's lumping me into that mystical world. What am I going to do about that? And I sat with it for a minute. It kind of like, I'm always sort of battling with that. Am I there or am I, where am I? And because what I would have said is that there's science there and there's philosophy there and there's art there. And isn't it interesting that I would sort of reach into that artistic frame and be nervous about that being mystical. Isn't that interesting? Why does that happen? Like, well, I was just curious in my own listening to your invitation where that tension was coming from. And I think just sort of over the course of this conversation that I have been thinking about that in the back of my mind somewhere. And thinking, I really am interested in the process of exploring our expression of the experience of this interdependency we're talking about. And in that exploration, I'm asking myself all the time, can I be more than I was? Can I find things I didn't find before? Can I discover sensitivities or sensations I haven't before? Can I begin to give more than I gave? Can I receive more than I have received? Can I be a better person? And sometimes when we get into that mystical realm, there becomes these sort of recipes of practice or methodology or some sort of prescription or existing script on how to have that integrity or that how to be more. And it makes me nervous. The scripting of that makes me nervous. Isn't that interesting?
It makes me want to do a warm data lab on mystical transfer, or like this kind of transformation that you're talking about, and to see what all the various context of that. Yeah,
right?
What's there? Yeah.
What's there? And why it's important to play with this space of what's there, because it's clearly so profound. It's what we share with each other and our world, and what we share in worlds beyond, right? So what is that? So that's a big question. I don't have any answers to that, but I just was noticing my own resonances around it and thinking.
Totally. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I'll just say, you know, quite simply, for me, you know, mysticism, I don't often use that word. It's interesting that I did. But for me, when I think of that, it is a kind of art, right? The art of perception itself, the art of seeing the world a certain way. And so those words are very interchangeable for me.
And it's seeing the world in lots of ways.
Yes.
Playing with those lots of ways, right? Yeah. So the artist has the palette, has the access to the materials through which there is this new expression that's possible. So anyway, on that note, thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you. And I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Nora.